The topics and opinions expressed on the following show are solely those of the hosts and their guests and not those of W4WN Radio, its employees, or affiliates. We make no recommendations or endorsements for radio show programs, services, or products mentioned on air or on our web. No liability, explicit or implied, shall be extended to W4WN Radio, its employees, or affiliates. Any questions or comments should be directed to those show hosts. Thank you for choosing W4WN Radio.
Well, hello and welcome to Fearless Fabulous You. I am your host, Melanie Young, and I am so happy you could join me today. I hope it's a good one for you. As you know, my mission is to help all of you women and men listeners out there make healthier choices to live a happier life. By changing your lifestyle, adding to it, making improvements, and of course, living fearlessly and fabulously in total confidence. I am dedicated to this, and one of the pleasures of my hosting the show on the Women for Women Network, which is podcast iHeart and iTunes, is that I get to interview some of the world's leading medical and wellness experts. I feel really lucky that in 5 years of my show hosting it, I've introduced some world leaders such as David Perlmutter, who is a brain health specialist, Dr. Joseph Deza, who is a leading breast reconstruction specialist, Dr. Philip Salem, a leading oncologist, Dr. Christy Funk, who is director of the Pink Lotus Wellness Center in Los Angeles, and so on. And I really make it my goal to get the best of the best of my show. I get pitched on a lot of specialists and experts in health and wellness, but I really vet hard. And that's why I'm super excited today, really super excited to have one of my favorite specialists in integrated health and functional medicine join me for the show. You may know him. He is Dr. Frank Lipman. He is a pioneer in both integrative and functional medicine and the founder and director of 1111 Wellness Center in New York City. He's also a New York Times best-selling author. You can find more at his new website, which is drfranklipman.com. I have heard him speak. As many of you know, I have another life in the food, heavy-duty food and fine dining world and have for 30-something years. And I've heard Dr. Lipman speak at dinners that my friend David Boulay, the chef, renowned chef host, because he's totally interested in integrative health from a food standpoint. And my other friend, who I've written about quite a bit, Seamus Mullen, and Dr. Lipman did the intro to one of his books. And I'm really excited because I have one of his books in front of me that I found to be such a really helpful read and one that I encourage all of you to get. I actually have the paperback and the hardback copy of How to Be Well, The 6 Keys to a Happy and Healthy Life. I want to welcome to the show today Dr. Frank Lipman. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for that great introduction, Melanie, and thank you for all the work you do.
Well, I have heard you speak, and I heard you lecture at Institute for Integrative Nutrition, which I attended. First, for all of our listeners, do tell people where that amazing accent is from.
Well, I come from South Africa. I was born in South Africa a long, long time ago, but I've been in America for almost 35 years now. So, I came when I was almost 30, so you don't really lose your accent, especially my wife's also South African, so I hear that all the time. So it's a South African accent.
Well, I want to tell you, I love it. And I have been to South Africa, and I'm a huge fan of the wines, which is a whole other discussion. But I do love the wines there. They are the best Chenin Blancs in the world. Yeah. They really are. So you've been practicing. So I have to ask you this. Your background a little bit, because integrative medicine is still for many people a newish term. And back when you started practicing it, it was kind of woo-woo for some people, a little too woo-woo. Did you start in Western medicine and then transition into integrative? So give us a little backstory there.
Sure. So I qualified as a physician, as a doctor in South Africa. And I believed in Western medicine. And, you know, in South Africa, you know, as with all doctors in America too, you get trained in the hospitals. You get trained in crisis care medicine. People are really ill. They're having acute heart attacks, pneumonias, They're breaking bones, and that's the way I and most doctors get trained. It's what I now call crisis care medicine. So I was trained like that, and I believed in Western medicine, and I still believe in Western medicine for crisis care. But soon after my training, when I started, when I worked in private practice and I started working in the bush as well in South Africa, you know, I realized very soon that Western medicine or crisis care wasn't particularly helpful for a lot of the people who were coming in with, they couldn't poop and they were tired and they had headaches and they were stressed out. And I had no tools that I was taught in my training to deal with these problems. So I realized early on in my career that, you know, I'd have to explore other modalities if I was going to help these people. And I was lucky enough to be exposed to some alternatives still in South Africa before I left. And that sort of opened my mind up because I realized that maybe there's something to these alternatives because they seem to be helping the patients we can't help. And then when I emigrated to the States in 1984, I had to do a residency I did a residency in internal medicine in the South Bronx in New York because I needed 3 years to get a license in New York. So I did internal medicine. And once again, I was working in the hospital and I saw how fantastic Western medicine was for these acute illnesses, you know, broken bones and heart attacks, people who are acutely ill. But after they were sent home from hospital, they were coming in with these chronic problems again, and I realized there must be something more, and there happened to be an acupuncture clinic attached to the hospital in the South Bronx doing acupuncture for detox. You know, heroin and crack were epidemics then. So I thought, well, let me go check this out because, you know, I need to see what else there is because Western medicine is not particularly good at dealing with these chronic problems. And lo and behold, after spending some time in the acupuncture clinic, I realized that acupuncture and Chinese medicine was actually really good at the problems that Western medicine wasn't good at, and vice versa. You know, that acupuncture was good at people who were tired and had headaches and couldn't poop and were stressed out, but it wasn't particularly appropriate for people who were acutely ill. So early on in 1984, I realized that the future of medicine would be some integration, some combination of this Western medicine crisis care that I and most doctors had been trained in. And what I thought was, it was, you know, I expanded afterwards, but at that stage it was my training in Chinese medicine. So I saw really early on that the future is going to be some combination of these two. So after I finished my residency, I went on an exploration of all different modalities. You know, I just went to study with various teachers, and I found nutrition teachers and more Chinese medicine teachers, meditation teachers, yoga, and I just lapped up all this information because I wasn't getting taught it in my regular model. And I, you know, after many years I started integrating some of these modalities into what I was practicing. So that's the short story.
Well, I think it's a great story, and I think that the key point is integrated medicine. So many people think it's an either-or situation, Western or natural, but it can be right. Both and. I mean, that's the term integrative. I always use that versus alternative. Some people use alternative, yep. Which, you know, you always have an alternative to anything you choose, but integrative is great. And I'll be honest with you, when I was treated for breast cancer in 2009 and 2010, I did not integrate alternative, you know, integrate natural medicine into my treatment at Memorial Sloan Kettering. And in hindsight, I was okay. I did okay on everything. But I think hopefully I'll never get diagnosed again with another cancer. But if I were, knowing now what I know now, in my own journey, I would definitely look at the bigger picture and see what else I could do to help with the healing process. Because doctors are really great at treating the acute condition.
Exactly.
But that's a condition, whether it's your kidneys or failing or your heart. But there's a head to toe issue going on as well, right?
Exactly. So I'm definitely not against. I think Western medicine is wonderful at certain mm-hmm. things. The problem is, you know, everyone thinks the doctor knows everything about everything. So if we could just be a little bit more open, you know, if I'm having acute chest pain or an acute asthmatic attack or I break a bone, I'm not going to go to an acupuncturist or an alternative or practitioner. I'm not going to go for a massage. So I just think we need to be smart about it. It's absolutely not either or. To me, good medicine is a combination of all the above.
And an informed patient knows to ask questions. And I'll give you some examples. You get sick, you go to the doctor, they give you a prescription for a medication. I am actually was recently with a friend in Florida who brought out a giant baggie of OxyContin over right. the years of medication for various surgeries. And now, thankfully, that's more regulated, thankfully. But right. It's like a natural instinct or protocol for many doctors to say, you're having anxiety, have a Xanax.
Exactly.
And I've been through that. And it's like not always the best thing because people get addicted or they get the side effects are not good for them and they become dysfunctional. Yes. Yeah, right?
So I think it's important for people to realize that symptoms are just a pointer to some imbalance or some problem in the body. And unfortunately, too often drugs are given to suppress these symptoms, and they don't resolve the underlying cause of the problem. And we also forget about the many side effects of just giving drugs, and it's often ineffective. So I think there's a place for drugs. They use, unfortunately, too often because our tools in Western medicine are drugs or surgery. And if that's appropriate, that's great. But I think we need to see why there's a symptom. As you said, if you have a headache, why do you have a headache? Don't just suppress a symptom, you know. I think that's really important for people to understand.
And I think, getting to the root of what the condition is, besides, the underlying aspects. And I think here I want to say, many people don't realize how important it is to invest in your health when you're well, than waiting until you get sick. Let's address that, because this is really the core of your book, How to Be Well.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yep. It is the core. I think people don't realize that the ordinary things we do on a daily basis have extraordinary healing effects, like having gratitude, being kind to others, being in community, maybe even having a pet, getting some sun. Yes, some sun. Everyone's scared of the sun, but, appropriate sun can be helpful. So I think my book is full of over 100 simple things that we take for granted, yet can really help us feel energetic and vital and healthy. So, the book was really about how do I actually share this knowledge that I've gained after all these years and seen how people can make small changes and create healthy habits and make huge changes to their health.
Exactly. And I want to underscore that many of the, even though the title is the 6 keys to a happy and healthy life, as you said, there's many, many within the chapters. There's a mandala, which we're going to get into, but there's many aspects. And I also want to underscore everybody listening that many of these simple changes are in front of your face.
Exactly.
They're not something that's not like hard to reach or you have to have money or you have to have more time. They are simple things. And I'd like to address some of these. I'd like to start actually with, because eating is a big topic, I actually want to start with something that I even think is critical and hand in hand with eating, which we'll get to, is movement. Because everybody, all the studies are showing that we are leading too sedentary in life, and that is definitely impacting our health in very serious ways. So that's why I want to start with movement, because to me, it's not always what you eat, but managing what's eating at you. And to me, movement is one of the most important ways to alleviate stress. Let's address that. Some tips.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about movement, I call it movement and not exercise, because you don't necessarily have to go to a gym. Mm-hmm. But moving your body improves everything, your metabolism, your immunity, your overall balance in your life, your stress response, your sleep, all your body rhythms, and even your microbiome, which we now know is a key to one's health. And the microbiome is this collection of all these bugs in your gut. So moving actually improves everything, improves the health of your brain, it improves muscle, improves every organ system. So moving your body as much as you can throughout the day is really good for your health. You know, especially most of us sit a lot, you know, while we're working. So just get up and move your body. I think it's important to realize you don't have to go to the gym. It's great if you go to the gym, but just move as much as you can.
And it's as simple as, you know, a tip that I do. I'm a writer. I'm at my desk a lot, but I get up. I have an alarm and I set it and I get up and do jumping jacks or go outside and play chase with my dog for like 10 minutes.
Yep.
Every hour and a half. And then when the news comes on, and who likes the news these days, I exercise.
Yep.
I use news as my time to watch the news, but kind of like do all my exercises. I always have the mat out. And that's 30 minutes right there.
Yep. And,
right?
You know, people don't realize, you know, for stress, a lot of people use exercise or movement for stress, which is great. Most of us are too stressed. So, you know, exercise will help that as well. And exercise can help your sleep. Exercise helps your brain. It's probably one of the best things you can do for your brain is to move your body.
Absolutely. And I every day, I think the recommendation is at least 35 solid movement minutes of movement a day, or five times a week. I think it should be daily. And you can chunk that. It doesn't have to be 35 minutes at one time. You can do it like 10 minutes here, 10 minutes here. And you mentioned the second thing I want to address, because I think movement is key, because it feeds your brain and keeps your body moving through your system moving. But as important as you just mentioned is rest. And that is one of, I'm going to do mandala too, or I'm kind of mixing them up. Why it's important to rest, and not only rest and sleep, but get productive sleep. So let's discuss some things you address in the book.
Well, sleep is probably the most underrated aspect of your health. You know, we worry about all those hours, what we're doing all those hours while we awake, and we forget about the important hours of when you're sleeping, because sleep is when your body restores itself. Sleep is, you know, there's something called the glymphatic system in the brain, and that's like an overnight cleanup system which keeps the brain clear and healthy, and it only works when you're sleeping. So when you're sleeping, your brain is removing these toxic proteins or these byproducts of neurological processes that accumulate between the cells during the day. And if you don't sleep at night, that cleanup crew is not going to work, and it's like having a party and you have a mess the next morning, and if you don't clean up the mess and you have another party the next night, you don't clean up the mess, after a couple of days the mess just increases and increases. And you know, there are more and more people, you know, believe that Alzheimer's disease, a big part of Alzheimer's disease is when this glymphatic system is not working appropriately. So it's not cleaning up these, you know, this accumulation of these these byproducts of neurological processes during the day. So sleep is key, and it's also when your body repairs itself. You know, for instance, if you are exercising intensely during the day, you need that sleep to recover when the muscles repair. Sleep is essential for focused mental performance, for a stable mood, for a strong immune system, for as I said, cellular health repair, healthy stress response. So I find it interesting. You know, we talk about movement being essential for all those things. Sleep is the same thing. It's essential for a good microbiome. So all these things we take for granted, moving our bodies, getting a good night's sleep, affect all aspects of our health and all organs of the body.
Exactly. And it's like the yin and the yang, because you've got to have both. Now, a lot of women cannot sleep when they're going through menopause or when they're, first, I mean, like almost every woman I know my age says, I have to get up in the middle of the night and go to the bathroom. And I will confess, Dr. Lippman, that I've been having a little bit of sleep disorder. I call them the 4 o'clock. So I'm not sure why I'm up at four, and I follow all the rules. Don't eat too late. Don't drink too much. You know, all the things you have a sleep preparation ceremony. What can women in particular do when they wake up in the middle of the night and they're sweating and they have to pee and then they can't go back to sleep?
Well, that's a good question, because that is a problem. Once your hormones start going a little bit awry with menopause, you know, there's a hormonal aspect that sometimes needs to be corrected with with hormone, you know, by what I would recommend, bioidentical hormones, but not everyone wants to do hormones or can do hormones. Like you, it would be contraindicated with, for instance, with your history. But the two things that I've found to be, or three things that I've found to be really helpful for sleep. One is to cut back on sugar radically. The more you can, if you can stop sugar, that often helps sleep. Second is some meditation. You know, learning to quiet the mind is really important. And the third thing, which I'm using more and more in my practice now, is CBD. And sometimes, you know, we can't use CBD and THC in New York, but in the States that you can get some THC. I mean, I have women who swear by, you know, you have got to find what works for you. But CBD alone can be helpful. If you have access to CBD and THC, apparently a one-to-one formula works really well, but you need to find what works for you. But I think starting to, you know, stopping sugar, learning to meditate or dealing with the stress, obviously exercising, and explore CBD because it can be extremely helpful.
Well, it's interesting because I was going to ask you about that a little later because it's exploding. But what about melatonin?
Yeah, well, melatonin is your sleep hormone. Sometimes it works for people, and especially if your melatonin is low, but it doesn't work for a lot of people. Especially as one gets older, I think it's not a bad idea to take melatonin anyway. It's probably got a lot of the anti-aging docs use it as an anti-aging supplement. So I think melatonin can help. I'm all for melatonin. I use melatonin, but it's not necessarily going to help you fall asleep. But sometimes it can help you with the waking up part. But I think, you know, you usually have to do more than just take melatonin. I mean, some people, melatonin works well, but I think you need to incorporate all these other tips as well.
And I'm also curious, I take melatonin and it does work. And I will tell you, I'm still kind of navigating the CBD thing.
Yep.
And the one I did, which was under the tongue, oh my God, I got the worst. It was like a hangover.
Yeah. Well, CBD is tricky because you've got to find the right brand, because there's so many different types of CBD, and not all are the same. And the CBD is not just CBD, the same CBD. You've got to find the dose that works for you. If you had too much of a hangover the next day, you may have taken too much. CBD is one of those supplements. Let's call it a supplement. It's going to be it's actually really a drug. But it's one of those drugs that you need to try and see what dose works for you, what brand works for you. It can be quite tricky, but when you crack the right one, it can be miraculous.
Well, I know my mother's using a salve for her rheumatoid arthritis that I've been sampling, and she swears by it, and I did a little bit for anxiety. I'm curious about this. I did a show with a doctor who wrote The Magnesium Miracle, and we did a whole show on magnesium. And she suggested magnesium for many things, including sleep. I have a spray I put on my feet. What's that all about? Does that really help? And what kind of magnesium?
I'm a huge, huge fan of magnesium. Firstly, because most people are actually deficient in magnesium. I tend to use oral versions, and they're different types. But, you know, magnesium can be absorbed well through the skin. So I don't know enough about topical magnesium, but I assume it should work. I don't use it personally. Or in my patients, I use oral magnesium. But I'm a huge fan of magnesium. I take it every night. I think most people are deficient. I think that's another good supplement that is worth taking anyway. And if you're taking it, take it at night because it can help you sleep too.
But a specific kind, because there's magnesium citrate, magnesium chelated.
Okay. So
let's explain that, because that's hard. When you go to the store, the labeling really is confusing.
So magnesium citrate and magnesium oxide tend to loosen your stools. So if you tend to be constipated, then I would use magnesium oxide or citrate. If you don't tend to be constipated, I would use chelated magnesium, magnesium glycinate, or magnesium threonate. So they're all different types of magnesium, but the two that will loosen your stools are magnesium oxide and magnesium chloride.
Which can have, so that's another a positive side effect if you have issues
exactly.
with your stomach. I don't know, honestly, I don't know if the spray works or not. I do put it on. I know that for me, the number one thing that does help, and this is somebody coming from the food business, I've learned to eat earlier. Eat less, later, lighter, later, and earlier.
Yes, well, that's definitely helpful. I'm actually a big, I don't know if you wanted to talk about intermittent fasting, but I'm a big fan generally of eating dinner earlier and eating breakfast later. So I think for many reasons, you know, just the one reason, just having a good, you know, 12, 14, even 16 hour fasting break, or what we call time restricted eating, I think is a good idea for your metabolism in general. For most people, some women have a bit of a problem with it, but eating earlier also is just good for, you know, your food's metabolized way before you go to sleep. So it's just a good idea to eat, you know, and a good number of hours before you go to sleep. It can help you sleep. It's just a good way of letting your body process the food before you go to sleep.
Well, it's interesting because we're going to move into the food part. And my friend practices intermittent fasting, who I recently visited. It was a little harder for me. I mean, for me, intermittent fasting, you know, for my own body clock, knowing where what my highs and lows, eat earlier dinner. So I try to get done by 9, which for us is early. And
that's
I
early?
Try.
God.
No,
late.
No. But we start eating at 7. It's a long process. So.
Right.
We tend to eat around 7. That's a big improvement from when I used to start at 8:30, Dr. Lemon, in the food world. But I also eat breakfast like at 9. So there, I allow a good period of time in between. There's a long period there called sleep where I'm not eating. And then I may wait until 3 to eat again. That's not quite intermittent fasting, but if I don't eat at 3, I'll chew somebody's head off.
Yeah, well, intermittent, the way I do the recommend the intermittent fasting, the way I do it myself is just I try finish dinner by 7 or 8 the latest, and
right.
then I wait a good 14 hours. So I don't really have breakfast. I have what I would call brunch.
Mm. If you can do that, it's a great idea. And I also want to now jump into because a lot of people think you need to have before we jump into food. One thing about intermittent fasting versus what I call interval eating, where you eat in certain intervals, because when I have been put on special diets to deal with my own metabolic issues, I was told eat the breakfast between this time, have a mini snack, have a lunch, have a mini snack, have a dinner. It seemed like there was a lot going on. I was like told to eat every 3 hours, and that's quite the opposite of intermittent fasting.
What
do you think about that?
Well, that's what I used to recommend even maybe 5 years ago. You know, I think what I've found is as you decrease the carbohydrates in your diet and you're not relying on carbohydrates as much for energy, then you don't need to eat as frequently as that. So I think once you start decreasing the carbohydrates in your diet and increasing the protein and the healthy fats, and you know the vegetables, the green leafy vegetables, you tend not to need to eat as frequently as that. So that's what I find with myself, with my patients. So I, as much as I used to believe that too and recommend that, I think the more we move away from this carbohydrate laden diet, it becomes less of a necessity to eat that frequently, because once you're eating more fat, you tend to remain fuller and satiated for longer. So that tends to change once you start changing your diet. And I think especially in menopause, I've noticed menopausal women tend to do better on a low-carb diet. Not everyone, once again, there's no one right diet for everyone, but
right.
as a general rule, as we get older, anyway, we tend to do better on a lower carbohydrate diet.
Absolutely, because again, you know, eating too many carbs can raise your glycemic level, and there you go. Here we go again with all the issues. I want to move into diet now that we've addressed interval eating versus intermittent fasting, and how your body, and this is really important, and I want everybody to understand that, that what you may have done as a teenager or in your 20s or when you were of childbirthing age is very different from what you may need when you're in your 50s, 60s, and 70s, right?
Exactly. It changes all the time, absolutely. Especially as we get older, you know, I'm 64 now. I mean, I can't, you know, I have to be on a low-carbohydrate diet. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, my sugar goes up and, you know, I put on weight and I get foggy thinking. So I just can't do it. So, and I see that all the time. As we get older, most of us tend to need to eat, you know, our capacity to metabolize carbohydrates tends to decrease. So we tend to do better on a lower carbohydrate diet.
So that's a really important point. It's like, ladies, you don't keep the same hairdo either. Make friends. So let's talk about now diet, which I always say is, if you reverse the words around, it's edit. So to me, it's about editing what you eat, not, you know, focusing on no, but adding in more, you know, crowding out the bad, adding in the good. So edit. Make friends with fat. You were very clear that many people misunderstand fat, because you hear the word saturated fat, fatty foods, fattening, you know, FAT, right? Let's put the spin on why eating fat is important and explain the that it's the kind of fat and also, how, you know, with how you consume it, right?
Exactly. So, you know, my philosophy on fat is basically, if it's made by God, it's probably healthy. And if it's made by man or in a factory, it's probably not. But fat is absolutely essential for every function of the body, and especially the brain, and as well as healing and repair processes. You know, a fat-starved brain, for instance, will cause anxiety and depression and brain fog and forgetfulness. So it's really important to not be scared of fats, but which fats you eat are very important. You know, this fat-free living that we've all endorsed for so many years has led us to eat much more sugar and unhealthy additives, which they add to the low-fat foods to give them flavor, which is removed when you take away the fat. And it's been part of why we have this obesity and, you know, diabetes and heart disease epidemic. So I think we mustn't be scared of fat. You know, I always tell people avoid low-fat and non-fat foods. Mm-hmm. But you know, here's a big caveat. Not that everyone should be scared of saturated fats, because, you know, it's all about the source of the fat. But, you know, now we're knowing more about, you know, genetic predispositions, and I'm sure you've had someone, if you've had David Perlmutter on, so they've talked about the ApoE gene, you know, the gene for Alzheimer's. You know, now there is some research out that, you know, this gene for Alzheimer's, if you have the gene, the ApoE4 gene, you should be eating a very low carbohydrate diet, but you shouldn't be eating too many saturated fats. So too much dairy may be a problem for you, maybe too much red meat may be a problem for you, but you can still eat a lot of the other, you know, the nuts and the avocado and the olive oil and the olives. So it's not that, you know, it's a little bit nuanced, the fat story, but as a general rule, I'm all for healthy fats. And I think if you do have this ApoE gene, which your doctor can check, then you just got to be careful with eating too many saturated fats. But I'm all for healthy saturated fats, but if you and in terms of Alzheimer's, actually a high-fat, low-carb diet is probably the way to go anyway. But if you do have this gene, just be careful with too many saturated fats. That would be my caveat.
But there's some wonderful plant-based fats, as you mentioned, avocado, coconut, nuts and nut butter, chocolate, olives and olive oil, tahini sauce. Yep. I eat all these. I love tahini. Probably love it too much, but because I get sick of nut butter. So you know, but it's a great alternative to nut butters or avocado. I mean, these are things you spread on a whole grain toast or on celery, you know, if you really don't want any grains. It's just divine and a great way to get your fat, right?
Yeah, and I think we've got to be careful of these vegetable oils. I think these vegetable oils are a big problem. You know, first of all, There's no vegetable in any vegetable oils. They're industrial seed oils. But, you know, because we have this huge fear of saturated fats, there's this proliferation of vegetable oils as cooking oils. And, you know, most of them are made from tough seeds, and they were originally grown for industrial use, not human consumption. And when you heat them, they get altered and they cause all sorts of inflammatory problems. So we just got to be careful with what we, it's not only what you eat and or when you eat, we talked about intermittent fasting, but it's also about what you cook with. And I think cooking with vegetable oils is a big, big problem that we only starting to realize now, as we know that sugar is a major problem. I think these industrial seed oils or these vegetable oils, even canola oil, just because they're low, they're not saturated fat, they're problems when they're heated.
That's what I, you know, there's been a, I've heard people praise canola and then say no, demonize canola. Just to be like, corn oil is one, a common vegetable oil, I think. And sadly, it's being advertised. I was, my jaw almost hit the ground when I saw an ad for a major corn oil company say that it's just as healthy as olive oil. I really almost just collapsed when I saw that ad. So don't, you know, I used to be in marketing and PR. I know the market. I know the spin. I play what's the catch here. Don't believe ads and marketing speak. You got to really dig, you know, be your own informed source and get a book like How to Be Well, the six keys to a happy and healthy life, where you have an informed source. Don't listen to marketers. And this comes from somebody who came from marketing. I want to talk about the other one everybody goes freaks out about, gluten-free. How to go gluten-free. Let's talk about gluten and the whole approach to living with without gluten.
Yeah, well, I think gluten tends to be a problem for most people I see. It doesn't mean the gluten-free products are healthy. I think we've got to be careful. But gluten tends to create an inflammatory reaction in most people. You know, we sort of think we understand why now, because, you know, we think maybe the gluten is altered in America. We think maybe, we don't know exactly for sure, but there could be many reasons. It's most wheat in America is sprayed with glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup. And glyphosate tends to be a, not tends, is a problem for most of us. It's a registered antibiotic, so it alters our gut flora. It's also carcinogenic, according to the World Health Organization. And just because your food's not genetically modified, it doesn't mean that it hasn't been sprayed with glyphosate. Almost all wheat and oats in America is sprayed with glyphosate right at the end of the crop to help with the drying process and increase the yield. So I think we don't know for sure, but it may be the glyphosate, it may be because the gluten is different, but it creates a reaction in our body. So I'm not a fan of gluten, but there are so many gluten-free products that are full of these starches and these other grains that, and sugar and additives that also create problems. So not that I'm a fan of gluten, but just be careful of gluten-free products. Just because it's gluten-free doesn't necessarily mean it's healthy.
Exactly. And you know, my theory is if it's in a box or a bag and it says gluten-free, there's something else in there. Trust me, there's something else they're putting in there. Lectin. Now, I learned a lot about lectin, looking beyond gluten. There was two things when reading your book that kind of made me think I need to do a little more research and address it in other ways. Lectin. What is lectin, and what's the deal with lectin and sensitivity, and what does it do for you? What should you be thinking about?
Well, so lectins are tricky. It's another protein. Gluten's actually a lectin that we find in most grains and even beans the vegetables with seeds. And it tends to be more of a problem with people who have an altered or an unhealthy microbiome. So if your microbiome and your gut is in good shape, you tend to be able to tolerate lectins. But if you look at most cultures, they have always, you know, if it was beans, they would soak their beans. If it was grains, even, they would soak their grains. There are ways of getting the lectin or the number of lectins in food down, so soaking your beans and soaking your grains, slow cooking your grains. So there are ways of decreasing the amount of lectins in your food. I try not to get people crazy. You know, it's about, you don't want to scare people away from
right.
food.
Right.
So I don't make a big issue of lectins unless people are having autoimmune problems or problems in general. I sort of, you know, we start going down the lectin route or explaining what lectins are. I do always mention them in my book. I mentioned it, but I think I'm always a little bit wary because you don't want to scare people off. You want
right.
people just to eat a healthy diet, but there are ways of decreasing the amount of lectins in your food, and these old cooking techniques that all cultures have had.
Well, I think, you know, what's important, you mentioned autoimmune and consideration of lectin. More women today are being diagnosed with autoimmune conditions.
Yes.
And there are many theories as to why this is, starting with the environment and our diet, right?
Yep.
And all the things you address. When someone comes to your clinic, 1111 Wellness, how is the experience different from going to your regular PCP?
Well, autoimmune is epidemic. I'd say 3/4 of the, you know, I'm sort of like a doctor of last resort. I've become, so a lot of us, probably almost 3/4 of the patients that come to me now have autoimmune problems. Mm-hmm. And it's sad to see because a lot of them are these young women. And my experience has been a lot of the time, the problem starts in the gut. And that's often these young women have had too many antibiotics that have destroyed the good bacteria in their gut. And, you know, when they have this altered microbiome and they get what we call a leaky gut, and once they have a leaky gut, then toxins and byproducts of food leak through this gut into the bloodstream, and the body reacts by protecting itself and making antibodies to these foods, and these antibodies then cross-react with different tissues of the body. So a lot of the time, the autoimmune problem starts in the gut. So when they go to a regular doctor, they have an autoimmune problem, they either get sent to a rheumatologist and get put on a biologic. These are these Humira and all these drugs that are used. But what we do in my clinic is we try to look for why there is this autoimmune reaction in the body. And it's often related to lifestyle. And in particular, it's often related to the gut and this leaky gut concept. So we always trying to, you know, with autoimmune problem, we may look at lectins, but it's always trying to correct the bowel, the microbiome, and this leaky gut.
It's very, very true, and I urge everybody to consider going to a functional medicine specialist. And when you autoimmune is something that you live with, and you don't want to live with taking pills all your life.
Exactly.
Because eventually they don't work. And I have my own autoimmune conditions that arose after cancer. My mother has RA. I see it. And I see how it's affecting my mother, who's practically crippled by her RA, and trying to help her through her diet right now. Now, this is a buzzword somebody pitched me on, and it's a big chapter in your book that I read with interest, under Protect, which is another one of your keys for a healthy life. Give your mitochondria what they need, not to be confused with hypochondria. Mitochondria are very important. Let's explain what they are, because I got pitched
sure.
a mitochondria specialist recently. I'm like, oh, that was in Dr. Lippmann's book.
Right. So the mitochondria are these energy powerhouses in your cells.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people, even in the anti-aging world, you know, reckon that when you decrease the amount and the functioning of your mitochondria, then you start aging. So, looking after your mitochondria is really, really, you know, these little energy powerhouses in your cells is very important. And how do you do that? You do that with a lot of the things we've been talking about. It's decreasing the sugar and the grains in your diet, because the mitochondria thrive on fat. They want fat, so you need good fats to feed the mitochondria. The mitochondria want these phytonutrients. They want all those goodies you get from vegetables. The mitochondria do better when you are dealing with your stress, when you're sleeping well, when you're getting some sun. Another way to improve mitochondria is to exercise, especially high-intensity interval training is particularly good for mitochondria. Another tip for to improve mitochondria is to go from hot to cold, so to go from a sauna into a cold plunging pool, or to go from having a really hot shower to a really cold shower. So there are many ways, it's all in the book, to improve the functioning of your mitochondria, but the mitochondria are probably the mechanism by which a lot of these lifestyle changes we're talking about are working in the body. And I also believe that the mitochondria are the Western equivalent of what we call qi or energy in Chinese medicine or in the East. In the East Chinese medicine, they talk about qi or energy flows in the body. And I think the Western equivalent is these mitochondria, because they're the energy powerhouses. So, looking after your mitochondria is key to your health and is key to aging well.
And it looks like, and you outline 14 things in the book on to help improve your mitochondria, given what they need. And all of them are things you can do every day. There is one supplementation. Now, I want to address that because it's a tricky-dicky topic because, as we know, there are people who are always selling supplements. It's an unregulated industry, but the FDA is looking into heavily regulating it. I know you sell them. When is it important? You used to. Okay, because at some point I saw them. Okay, so you don't. I want to address supplements because I've been the stupid thing and listened to people and tried them and not again to try. I tend not to supplement. I eat, I exercise, I sleep, I practice, I play. That's one of your tips to play like a child. is your message about supplementation?
I'm actually a big fan of supplements if it's targeted supplementation. I do believe, and I understand the problems of supplements. So to me, it's just one small part of a big healthy lifestyle picture. But I do believe that our food probably in this day and age doesn't have all the nutrients we need. Right. And we're under so much stress, so many toxins, environmental stresses, psychological stresses out there that our body probably needs more nutrients. So I'm a big fan of targeted supplementation. So if magnesium's low, I give magnesium. Vitamin D's low, I give, vitamin D. If people are looking to, improve mitochondrial function, there are certain supplements that may help mitochondria. There's certain supplements that may have, benefits for heart health. So I think you need to be smart about supplements because, as you say, they're not regulated. But I do think there is an important role that supplements can play in one's health. To me, it's just another part of moving and learning to chill out and sleeping properly and eating properly. It doesn't negate any of that. You can't just take supplements and ignore all these other factors. Right. To me, it's just another aspect of one's health. If you want to improve one's health, you can, try some supplements, but it should be targeted. You should work with someone who understands supplements, and you shouldn't just take any supplement. It should be what you and your body need.
Exactly. So don't just, look at don't just read the ad. Go to someone. It's intelligent supplementation not alternative. It is supplement. Again, the word is you are supplementing because you may lack something in everything you're doing. If all else fails, then supplement. I want to address two other areas that I thought were really important and fun that we don't think about the importance, but they are. And one was connecting and really keeping your mind limber and obviously relationships, but learning to relax and laugh, play, be crafty, use your hands. We don't do that anymore.
Yeah. So there's so many little things that we can do for our health that are usually free, whether it's going for a walk in nature, going for a walk on the beach, meditation. To me, meditation is actually essential for our, to help you manage the pressures of contemporary living. Yes. Meditation is like a vacation for your mind and body, and you can take it anytime, and it's free. So, you know, there's an epidemic of multitasking in our culture, and, you know, being mindful and learning to be is sort of the antidote for that. So I think, to me, meditation is something that's essential, and you can do it anytime. And that's just one thing. I think being part of a community is also very important.
Very.
I think, you know, you talked about playing. I think having more fun, laughing, all these little, you know what I said earlier. I think, you know, these ordinary things that we do on a daily basis have extraordinary healing effects, and we don't,
right.
we ignore it. And I think that is, you know, you're ignoring it to your detriment there. To me, that's more important than anything else. You know, I think, you know what I always say, it's these intangible things like relationships, a sense of purpose, mm-hmm. a feeling of belonging. These are, you know, having gratitude, being kind, they're all as influential to your health as almost anything you can measure or test in a lab.
Exactly. And these are all at your fingertips, everybody. And that is a great way to end the show. How to Be Well, The 6 Keys to a Happy and Healthy Life by Dr. Frank Lipman. DrFrankLipman.com website, 1111 Wellness Center in New York City, correct? I love talking to you. I believe in everything you're doing. I practice it myself after learning the hard way what happens when you don't. And I urge everybody to embrace it. Be a little selfish. It's good to be selfish and take care of yourself, because you want to be there for everybody else. To all, stay fearless and fabulous, and thank you for joining me today.